exactly like you.
Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. It's 13 minutes past 9 o'clock on this Friday, the 12th of April. A delight to have you here. Thank you so much for being with us and to be in our company. We greatly appreciate it, as always. And we really, we love that you're here. We love that you're ready to talk about the issues of the day. And we invite you to be a part of the conversation. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We'll give that out a lot over the next hour and 40 minutes. It is also a great pleasure to be able to introduce our panelists this morning as we make through the news of the day. Former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics, and a person I don't feel like that I've seen or talked to in a long time. Judith Eng, good morning. How are you?
Hey, Joe. Good morning. It's so good to be with you. I want to tell you where I was last Friday, because I know I've been MIA for a while. I was speaking at a environmental journalism conference in Philadelphia at 10, and a workshop is about to start on transitioning away from fossil fuels. And I'm the fifth floor of the Annenberg Center, and the building shook like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
For about 30 seconds.
Right.
And I automatically went into EPA emergency response mode, and I jumped up and looked out the window. Thank goodness everything was fine. But I thought it was really weird that I was in a room with about 50 journalists, and no one popped up and looked out the window. So it was pretty significant in Philadelphia last Friday.
Yeah, I've heard that, and it's city I'm from, and a lot of friends have told me that it was quite significant. I will say this, and maybe this is a cheap shot against the city of brotherly love and the city that I love very much, but, you know, having things shake and move and loud noises, I don't think is all that unusual.
Yes, although the building was swaying.
Well, it's a delight. Thank you for being back. We really enjoy having you here. Ulster County Controller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher. Good morning, March. How are you?
Good morning. I'm happy to be here. Yeah, our building was shaking. The county office building was shaking in Kingston a week ago. And it's only the second time I've experienced an earthquake, and I really hope it's the last. I prefer to have my feet on the ground. Happy to be here.
I will say to you, the panelists, myself and the panelists who were in this room, the people on the outside of this room felt it. We did not feel it at all in this room. So we consider this to be the bunker. So I think I want you to feel safe in this room. I think you're safe because we didn't feel anything. Now, right outside the door, people felt a lot, but we did not. Jim Hendler joins us, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. You know, the earthquake was felt up at RPI, but, you know, where Marjorie Greene says the eclipse, the earthquake, and our snow in April were signs from God that it's time to repent, I just want to say that we had just turned on our new quantum computer, and we want to apologize for causing all these things.
We had a major deadline in the controller's office, and I said to one of my staff, you didn't have to go this far to get out of the deadline.
Yeah. Get out. We're not used to that nonsense. But, we made it through. Here we are, another week, another Friday, and a lot to talk about, so we'll get right to it. I'll start with a story, and just because I think it happened as we were going off the air yesterday, and it broke, and we couldn't confirm it before we left the airwaves, so we didn't talk about it, and then obviously it was mentioned all day during on the news, but O.J. Simpson passing, the football great whose trial for murder became a phenomenon in the early 90s, died at the age of 76. This is a complex and complicated story for so many reasons, but you have this football superstar who then became a symbol of domestic violence and racial division after he was found guilty of murdering his ex-wife and her friend in a trial that riveted, he found not guilty, did I say that? Not guilty, of murdering his ex-wife and her friend in a trial that riveted the nation and had legal and cultural repercussions for years afterward. He was 76 years old. The cause was cancer. He had served 9 of a 33-year sentence for kidnapping and armed robbery unconnected to the death of his ex-wife before he was released in October of 2017 from the Lovelock Correctional Center outside of Reno, Nevada. It was a stunning downfall for a man who had risen from a poor neighborhood in San Francisco to become one of the greatest running backs in football history, an actor in more than 20 Hollywood movies, a corporate pitchman sprinting through airports for Hertz Rent-A-Car, of course, in his most memorable TV commercials, and a TV sports commentator. He had good looks, a warm smile, and a poised manner. That made him a popular sports media personality long after his playing days had ended. The double murder charges shattered his reputation as a high-achieving, amiable star. Murder charges will do that. He was accused of killing Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman in a brutal knife attack on the walkway outside her townhouse in Brentwood, in the Brentwood section of Los Angeles in June of 1994. Combining issues of race, sex, and celebrity, the murders and their aftermath quickly became what Time magazine called the Godzilla of tabloid stories. For anyone who was aware and living through that period of time, it was hard to get away from any aspect of that story and of the trial and of the aftermath for a really, really, really long time. The Simpson case showed that when it came to law enforcement and belief in the police and the judicial system, black people and white people in 1995 lived in different countries, and that was something that the country really didn't want to be reminded of, that according to author and legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin, the case sure brought it home, he says. All right. Who would like to start us off on O.J. Simpson? I know, Jim, you were excited. But yes, Marge, go ahead.
Sorry. I was a student at Boston University School of Law at the time, and when the verdict was read, I was in the student union with my black colleague friends, law students, and there was an absolute divide in the room. We had to have at least 200 or 300, 250 people in there, and the black students stood up and cheered, and the white students wilted, and it was a shocking moment for me to see the difference in the reception. And I think the cheers really had to do with the fact that finally they felt like someone of OJ's status was able to attain the representation that a typical, white, rich celebrity would have, and get an acquittal in a way that a white, defendant would have done. And it was really just shocking. I saw Wesley Morris's column in the New York Times this morning. He said OJ was an earthquake. That was the title on the column. And I have to agree, just going back to our comments on the earthquake, it really highlighted the divide in the way black and white Americans, and particularly black and white law students, saw the justice system. And then I just want to mention one last thing, which is that I saw a comment this morning that, OJ Simpson played football from the time he was in high school, and we know that brain injuries are associated with violence, and he probably was also a victim of having a traumatic brain injury that resulted in his violent temperament. Because it's not just this instance, right? There were other instances.
Yes, there were. Judith.
Well, remember, the verdict came not long after the police that beat up Rodney King were acquitted. And I think that had a lot to do with this cultural moment. March is absolutely right. There was a tremendous diversity in how people viewed the verdict. 150 million people watched the verdict be delivered live. It was one of these iconic moments. I certainly was focused on the fact that Nicole Brown Simpson was abused by O.J. Simpson for years. I mean, there was evidence of years of domestic violence there. And, you know, it's the car chase, you know, with the white Bronco, the flair of the attorneys. You know, if the, what did Johnny Cochran said, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. I mean, this really was a made in California trial with just enormous cultural and social implications. And while O.J. Simpson was not found guilty of the double homicide, he later was found civilly liable. So, you know, I think it also was, it feels to me like it was the moment that the media shifted in the way they covered news. This was a celebrity, of course. I kind of forget that he was an NFL running back. I just think of him as someone who murdered his wife and Ronald Goldman and got away with it. But I think the deeper issue is how people responded and then how mainstream media shifted the way they covered not only criminal trials, but kind of celebrity visibility linked to important social issues that are going on. I mean, I don't know, Joe, you're the media expert. Wasn't this a bit of a shift in the way a trial was covered?
Oh, I think so. I mean, it became 24/7. I remember there was one point where there was one aspect of the trial and that was closed to cameras, and I believe it was Court TV, had actors who were actually reading the transcripts at night because it had become such a phenomenon. And everyone in that case, from the judge, Lance Ito, who weirdly had like these timepieces and hourglasses on his desk, and people from all over the world were sending them to him on the bench, and that was odd. And then, of course, the legal dream team that was Alan Dershowitz and Barry Scheck and Johnny Cochran, Rob Kardashian. So it was a really it was, and then of course Marsha Clark and Christopher Darden on the other side. It was I think it really did. I mean it stopped. And I would say it led, I don't know how you feel about this, I think this is what you're referring to, Judith, but I think it sort of set a template for the breathless, round-the-clock journalism that was the 2015-2016 election cycle with Donald Trump.
Yeah, thank goodness Donald Trump was not president when this trial was happening, but I don't think this was good for anyone. It wasn't good for the victims of this crime, and it wasn't good for this media pivot.
Caitlyn Jenner tweeted yesterday, good riddance. Caitlyn was married to the late Nicole Brown Simpson's best friend, Kris Jenner. Jim.
You know, what's funny is my memories of O.J. actually come from my childhood, because one of my dad's clients one year gave him some season tickets to the New York Jets games back when. And, it was one of the bonding experiences with my father, who had never shown any interest in sports, nor had I until we started watching. And I remember sitting in the rain watching O.J. break the running back record of the day. I must admit that during the trial, it was a period of my life where I was up for promotion and not paying attention to anything outside of my office. So it kind of broke over me, but without the emotional impact. And then the later trial sort of came more by surprise. I think that I agree about a lot of the coverage and things, but I think there was also a lot of, I want to say irony, and that's not quite the right word. You know, the memes that came out of the trial, again, if the glove don't fit, you must acquit. Johnny Cochran became a popular, well, a satirical Johnny Cochran became a popular Saturday Night Live character. You know, it really was, he really was someone who had culturally been very involved, had you know, in a sense, almost like three, maybe even four different life stories. And so I do agree he was an interesting and controversial figure. But I think it says a lot about race in America that it became such a racial issue as opposed to justice and things, and not so much in a negative sense. I mean, it really did bring to light some of the inequities in the American judicial system, which we're still fighting with today with things like bail reform and things like that, where, you know, if you have a lot of money and break the law, you're in a different position than if you don't. And, you know, I think there was a lot of sort of understanding of that that grew for a while around the time of the trial.
I think one of the most bizarre things, we have to take a break, but one of the most bizarre things of all of the bizarreness around that was when he wrote the book, If I Did It, Confessions of the Killer, and putting a supposedly hypothetical description as to what happened. I mean, that's bizarre.
Who would do it?
Yeah. Really bizarre. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Starting off with the story about O.J. Simpson dying at the age of 76 yesterday, and looking at various aspects and implications and impacts of his life and the murder trial and the civil trial and the trial after that ultimately sent him to jail and then being released from jail. So a lot there to kind of go through. We do have letters from folks. Christopher writes, L.A. cops tried to set up a perfectly guilty suspect and it backfired. That according to Christopher. Hate to be a nerd or snarky, but I'm more interested in Jim's quantum computer launch than rehashing OJ. He'll have his time, I promise you.
I'm sure that'll be on a Vox Pop, April yes, 16th.
There you go. See?
2 p.m.
There you go. Not far. Just a few days away. And and I agree. Well, that also gets to Judah's point. I mean, there was a point for any of us living. I mean, you know, you turn on the television, you're like, oh, my God. Really? We have to watch this again? And it wasn't. It was endlessly fascinating because it just unraveled before your eyes, but there were so many weird twists and turns that it made it very difficult to completely turn your back on it and walk away.
To say he was perfectly guilty, like the writer of the letter said, I don't necessarily feel that that's a true statement. There were no witnesses. You know, there was no murder weapon. Right. So things that you would typically have were not available for the prosecution. And, you know, if it had not been a celebrity case, if it had not received the kind of notoriety that it did, if it did not attract the dream team in defense counsel, you know, but there had been an acquittal because there was no murder weapon and no witnesses, we might have just shrugged and said, like, yeah, that makes sense. So I feel that, you know, to say it was a perfectly guilty defendant is a little bit brushing over the facts.
Joe, let me take something in a slightly different direction. You know, he was later civilly found liable. And, you know, recently a major political figure has been civilly found guilty of sexual abuse. And yet, everybody ignores it. And I think people not understanding the difference between civil trials and you know, felony charges and et cetera, which, you know, again, I realize is a complicated issue, but, you know, civil trials do matter and they do need evidence and they do, you know, have to show things. So, again, I'm sort of moving it away from OJ a little bit and I'll let us go back in a second. But I just want to say, you know, it was, again, this notion that who cares that you were found civilly guilty of something is something that really is broken in our society.
Well, it was broken also because we saw this huge amount of money that he was to pay the Goldman family, and yet he was always out on the golf course. He was going from, you know, spot to spot. He had endorsement deals. He was going doing all kinds of things. I mean, it didn't seem to alter his life anyway. I mean, I'm sure it did in some way, but it really didn't seem to. From the outside, he was still living what I think we could refer to as a celebrity life, up until the next time that he was found guilty, and went to jail. Kathy writes, in retrospect, I now realize that the OJ thing was not really about race; it was about male power and wealth, and how that trumps legal justice and always trumps. And how that, I say, I was actually thinking it was Trump. So let me do a second read on this. It was always about male power and wealth and how that trumps legal justice and always trumps women's rights. Judith.
Why are you calling on me? Yes. the parallels with Trump cannot be ignored. You know, I think two things can be correct at the same time. I do think, as a society, the OJ trial was a lot about race and people feeling like the LAPD did not properly handle the Rodney King case just prior to this, and the domestic violence element to this. I think the letter writer, Kathy, is correct. It is about power and money and, you know, the profound problem with our criminal justice system. You can buy your way out of serious jail time if you have a strong legal team. And, you know, all due respect to public defenders, if you're represented by a public defender versus Johnny Cochran, it's not equal justice. So, you know, in this situation, I think there are significant racial implications on the verdict. And I think OJ did do it. I mean, there's not, I think, a lot of concern in my mind that he might have been unfairly sent to jail, and he was later sent to jail. But we just have these profound problems that have only gotten worse since 1994, in my mind, in terms of access to legal resources and racism and sexism within the criminal justice system. It certainly has not gotten any better.
Vesta writes, the 24/7 frenzy around the OJ trial caused viewers to shift from local programming of news to cable news coverage. Supposedly, Rupert Murdoch grew enraged that Ted Turner and CNN raked in over $200 million during that time and launched Fox News in 1996 as a right-wing programming alternative. Mm-hmm. What consequences for everything, says Vesta.
It's a good point.
Very, very good point. Scott writes, let's remember, this is similar to what Judith was saying earlier, let's remember the racial context of the trial. OJ, a larger-than-life African-American icon, allegedly killing two white people, including his beautiful blonde wife. Meanwhile, this came on the heels of the 92 acquittal of the four police officers who beat Rodney King. And, of course, OJ's counsel raised critical issues with regard to the racist backstory of L.A. investigator Mark Furman,
This kind of goes back to what Jim was saying a moment ago about, you know, the difference between a civil and a criminal trial. And, you know, in this case, a criminal verdict is when you find that beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a much higher standard. Yeah. And that's why people don't give the same credence to a civil determination, which is, you know, a preponderance of the evidence. It only has to be just a hair's breadth over 50% to be a preponderance of the evidence. So I can just say my black friends, at the time, their take was it wasn't necessarily whether he was guilty or not. And yeah. I hear what Judith is saying.
That's fair.
Their issue was that a rich white celebrity clearly would have been able to get off by hiring the right counsel and working the system. And this trial proved to them that indeed a rich black celebrity could too. And that was a victory in their minds because it showed some level of equality that had not been previously available. I know that's a horrible thing to say, but that was the sentiment at the time in the room.
That's a good point, actually.
Suzanne writes to us and says they spent most of that summer studying abroad in France and honestly completely forgot it was happening. When I arrived back in the U.S., it was like being physically hit in the face with wall-to-wall OJ coverage. It made me hyper aware of news saturation, narratives, and while they have certainly become far more ubiquitous, they immediately turned me off and made me distrust the facts aren't being subordinate to sensationalism. That from Suzanne. And
remember, the Trump trial starts on Monday with DA Alvin Bragg, and I wonder if we'll get the same wall-to-wall coverage on Trump.
Oy.
Yeah, there. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other topics. I welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Judith Eng, March Gallagher, and Jim Hendler making up the panel this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let us talk. We'll put this into Judith's wheelhouse, and we'll talk about this a little bit. For the first time, the federal government is requiring municipal water systems to remove 6 synthetic chemicals linked to cancer and other health problems that are present in the tap water of hundreds of millions of Americans. The extraordinary move from the Environmental Protection Agency mandates that water providers reduce a substance collectively known as PFAS, P-F-A-S, to near zero levels. The compounds found in everything from dental floss to firefighting foams to children's toys are called forever chemicals because they never fully degrade and can accumulate in the body as well as the environment. The chemicals are so ubiquitous they can be found in the blood of almost every person in the United States. A 2023 government study of private wells and public water system detected PFAS chemicals in nearly half the tap water in the country. Exposure to PFAS has been associated with metabolic disorders, decreased fertility in women, developmental delays in children, and increased risk of some prostate, kidney, and testicular cancers. That according to the EPA. So now the federal government is requiring municipal water systems to remove those chemicals from the tap water of millions of Americans. Judith, let me just start with my first reaction to this story, which was, why was that ever allowed for those chemicals to be in our tap water?
Well, no one ever approved it being in our drinking water. But what has happened is across the country, you have various forever chemicals that have leached into groundwater and surface water. And unless the public water suppliers are testing for it and have a very strict standard, they just, you know, they don't take action to get it out of the drinking water. So this is, you know, decades and decades of a toxic legacy. And I really applaud the EPA decision to establish these drinking water standards. And we have a very significant local hook to this, which is the Hoosick Falls and Petersburg situation. And then even the Norlite hazardous waste incinerator, which I pray will be closed permanently. Norlite was burning It was called AFFF, which is toxic firefighter foam, because firefighter foam contains a lot of PFAS. And Department of Defense sent that to Norlite to be burned. The state never told the community. We had to pass state and local laws to prohibit that. And so, you know, there's a long, long toxic legacy here that goes from drinking water contamination to air pollution if they're foolishly going to burn PFAS chemicals, which happened at Norlite.
What is it about, talk a little bit of how they get into the water supply in the first place, and how, of what goes into the process of getting them out?
Yeah, well, the good news is you can get it out with carbon filtration, or like you basically put a gigantic carbon filter either on the public water supply, or if you have a private well, you can, at fairly reasonable cost, install carbon filtration. You can put it just at your sink for drinking water, or you could do a whole house system, or you can use another technology called reverse osmosis. You can get it out if you know that it's there. You know, I can tell you the way it got into the Hoosick Falls water supply was there's a company called St. Gobain, which is very, very close. 500 yards away is the St. Gobain plant from the groundwater wells that provided drinking water for the village of Hoosick Falls. And so somehow St. Gobain let this chemical from their facility get into the soil and the groundwater. And, you know, terrible that the public water supply wells were just 500 yards from the plant. And so those wells became contaminated. And unfortunately, the state of New York and the mayor of Hoosick Falls at the time, not the current mayor, they stood behind this regulatory shield and said, well, there are no clear, safe drinking water standards here for PFAS chemicals. So we don't need to tell the public that they've been drinking contaminated water. And they were technically correct. The way the Safe Drinking Water Act works is EPA or the states establish a drinking water standard called a maximum contaminant level. But what happens is whenever EPA does that, they get battered by not only the companies that don't want to pay to get the chemicals out of the drinking water, but the companies, the polluters, very shrewdly put the local governments and the public water supply providers in front as you know, the message, oh, it's going to cost water ratepayers more money to get this out of the water. And so this is like a terrible regulatory failure because of pressure from polluters and the people that give them green cover, often water supply companies and local governments. And so what we were able to do in Hoosick Falls, though, is when EPA doesn't establish a drinking water standard, the EPA does have something called a health advisory warning, which has very solid science behind it. Andrew Cuomo and his administration kept criticizing EPA for first we blew the whistle on Hoosick Falls and told residents to stop drinking the water because it was contaminated, something the state health department refused to do. And Andrew Cuomo kept harping on the fact that there's no official drinking water standard and the health advisory warning doesn't have the same legal effect as an official drinking water standard. So this announcement by EPA this week takes that defense away from the Andrew Cuomos of the world. I'm sorry if this is rambling. I want to make two other points. One is it's a very good regulation that's going to save lives and avoid cancer incidents. But we're not out of the woods because the polluters will sue to try to get this overturned. And my second point is what you hear from polluters and sadly from government regulators sometimes is forever chemicals are everywhere. PFAS is everywhere. You know, we really, we can't chase down every last molecule. So now what's often happening is when contaminated drinking water is discovered, eventually carbon filtration is installed, but then the regulatory agencies do not aggressively go look for the source of the PFAS. So while our top priority is always protecting public health and making sure that people are not drinking contaminated water, it's also important that you find out where the PFAS is coming from and that you require companies like Saint-Gobain and Honeywell and others to clean up their messes, not that they just walk away because carbon filters are installed on drinking water supplies.
I'm so happy to hear Judith say that as a elected official on the finance side. You know, my county doesn't operate any water systems, but plenty of our towns and villages do. And I think it's interesting that we've seen these large settlements. You know, 3M settled for between $10.5 and $12.5 billion on this PFAS issue in litigation with Stewart, Florida, and 300 other municipalities. DuPont reached a $1.8 billion settlement for another 300 municipalities. I'm not sure if they're the same plaintiffs. But what it means is that the municipalities and operators of these water systems are going to have to then go after the polluters in a very direct way. And that is going to be costly and time consuming to get done to protect.
Yeah, and so, the polluters, good points, and the polluters don't cooperate. Saint-Gobain has still not settled with Hoosick Falls. They're just dragging this out for years. I mean, there have been some private litigation, some toxic tort cases. But I think also the bigger issue here is companies are still using a lot of PFAS. It's legal for them to use it. Beyond Plastics is working on an important bill in the New York State Legislature to reduce packaging. That will provide some taxpayer relief, March, and also good for the environment. Part of that bill is to prohibit the most toxic chemicals used in packaging, including PFAS. PFAS is still currently used in packaging. There was just a report that came out a few days ago that PFAS has been found in Band-Aids that we use because it's still
right?
widely used.
Is it adhesive, nonstick pans,
yeah.
water repellents, shampoos, cosmetics? I mean, it's really everywhere. And it's not just manufacturing operations that are discharging it to the environment. I mean, we have contamination of Washington Lake, which is a water source for Newburgh, and that's from the National Guard site there. So, you know, it's used also, I think, by in some of the chemicals that fire departments use. So it is everywhere. And water is the way that it's being delivered to 300 or 200 million Americans is what they're saying. But how are we going to get rid of it from these other places? That's my question.
Jim.
So, Judith, I'd like to follow up on that point you made about the polluters suing. I mean, in Michigan passed a PFAS regulation of its own. It went through the state court. I believe the last ruling on it was in 23, where the appeals court in Michigan ruled that the state's drinking water regulations were invalid, as the mm-hmm. regulators did not properly, you know, mm-hmm. determine the cost. And so we know this Supreme Court has been waiting for a case to really stifle the agency's powers to do a lot of regulation. I mean, they've signaled that in a couple of smaller cases. Do you think this might be that case?
Yes, but there's also a case coming up much quicker having to do with deference to regulatory agencies. It's
yeah.
referred to as the Chevron deference.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this will involve not only EPA, but FDA and USDA. There's a case in front of the Supreme Court now that basically may strip federal regulatory agencies of their ability to do strong regulations, basically agency deference. We'll see how that goes. That is very, very worrisome. But I could also see, Jim, this federal regulation being challenged and going all the way up to the Supreme Court. You know, the thing about EPA, and I was very proud to work there during the Obama administration, but it is fair to say that EPA is very slow. But one of the benefits of it being slow is it is really thorough, has excellent scientists, and I believe this regulation that they announced this week is solid. It will stand up to scientific scrutiny, and I think it'll stand up to legal scrutiny, but it's always quite harrowing when you think of, you know, Brett Kavanaugh and Clarence Thomas making a judgment of, is it okay to have cancer-causing chemicals in our drinking water?
We have a lot of letters on this, and I want to get to them and give them some time with our panel. So we'll take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll go to the letters, and then we'll move on to other subjects as well. We welcome your letters at panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Before we do all of that, news with Ray Graff.
I'm waiting so long.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. A lot going on this morning. We are talking about forever chemicals that the EPA say must be removed from drinking water. We do have many letters on this, and I want to get to those in just a second. I also want to mention that, Judith, you have an event. You will be speaking with Dr. David Carpenter at an environmental justice event, a memorial lecture on environmental justice for the Justice Center of Rensselaer County. Tell us more, please.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. I'm really looking forward to speaking at this event organized by the Justice Center of Rensselaer County. It's on environmental justice. I'm going to do a lecture on plastic pollution, which, by the way, PFAS is in plastic. We're going to hear from the amazing Dr. David Carpenter, who's a public health physician at the Albany School of Public Health. And then after that, there's going to be a wonderful panel of Capital District environmental advocates talking about local issues. So Bob Wilton will talk about the Dunn landfill. Joe Ritchie with Lights Out Norlite will talk about the horrible pollution from the Norlite hazardous waste incinerator in Cohoes. Barbara Heinzen with Clean Air Coalition of Greater Ravenna Cleemans will talk about the pollution from the Lafarge cement plant in Ravenna Cleemans. And then Gray Campbell Cohen will talk about lead pipe replacement in Troy. So it is a packed afternoon. It's this Sunday from 1 to 3. It's free and open to the public. And, you know, after the talking and discussions, there'll be refreshments and time to network. And I'm really excited that the Justice Center has pulled this together. So it is at Albany School of Public Health, but it's in the city of Rensselaer. It's One University Place in Rensselaer. And come at 1 o'clock and stop by the Beyond Plastics table to say hi.
Excellent. Good stuff. I hope you have a wonderful turnout for that. We'll mention it again at the end of the program, or at least I'm going to say that now, and I'm sure I'll remember.
We'll remind you.
Yeah, Judith will remind me. All right, let's go to the letters on this subject. Saint-Gobain bought a Honeywell plant that had polluted for years. This is a small addition to Judith's good narrative. They were the new owner and found out about the PFAS contamination after they bought it, and to their enormous credit, they stepped up and spent zillions of dollars rectifying a problem that wasn't officially on their watch. They were good citizens. Do you agree with that letter, Judith?
No.
Somehow I thought you would not.
This must be a Saint-Gobain media person writing in. The way the law works is there's something called strict joint and several liability. So the companies like Honeywell that created the problem is responsible, and the current owners are responsible. But Saint-Gobain dragged their feet and did not cooperate with getting a full cleanup here or getting justice for the people whose health was damaged by this contamination. And, you know, parts of Hoosick Falls are, you know, people should know that the drinking water is safe now because of the installation of carbon filters. But many parts of Hoosick Falls are designated for Superfund site cleanup. You know, this story is far from over. And I would not describe Saint-Gobain as a good neighbor or a good partner in this at all.
Joe, can I comment on that?
Sure.
I had a time in my life where I worked in a corporate law firm and represented very large PRPs. Those are, you know, responsible parties under Superfund. And the mantra was money later is better than money now. And it didn't matter. Mm. We knew we were going to help our clients were going to be held liable, but the longer we could delay, that was the goal. And I think that echoes here as well.
We have many other letters. Let's go to Colleen. It seems to me that these forever chemicals are just some renamed part of the DuPont C8 chemicals that were discovered to be very harmful 40 years ago.
Yes, they are the C8 chemicals. And if people don't want to listen to me drone on about forever chemicals, I recommend you watch the movie Dark Waters, which is featuring the work of this crusading lawyer, Robert Ballot, and starring Mark Ruffalo. And it's a true story, and it talks about how companies in West Virginia and Ohio manufactured these facilities. It's a much greater risk if you live near the manufacturing facilities as opposed to places like Petersburg and Saint-Gobain and Newburgh, where there was extensive use of the chemicals. But these are the same chemicals. Regulatory agencies have known about this problem for years. I do want to add, I appreciate Mark mentioning Newburgh, where the U.S. military has some responsibility for water contamination. And I read recently that the U.S. Defense Department is in Congress trying to get the military exempted from any liability involving PFAS chemicals, which, of course, would be a terrible mistake. And I hope that Senator Schumer and Gillibrand and other congressional representatives in the region vigorously oppose Department of Defense trying to make sure that there's no liability for their contamination.
Bill writes, to the point that PFA are everywhere, I'd like to remind the panel that the state of Connecticut had banned the placement of solar farms in drinking water reservoir watersheds because of the risk of PFAS running off from these large arrays of the treated solar panels.
I'm not at all convinced that solar panels are a PFAS risk. I think that was probably used as an excuse by people who don't want to look at large solar farms.
And may I jump in there for a second, since Teresa Bourgeois is not here today, but one of the things she's been very big on is what are called floating solar arrays, which is you take a municipal reservoir and put a solar array on it, and they actually have beneficial both economic and ecologic impact, as well as generating power. So, you know, this is, again, the notion that that would somehow be a PFAS threat is absolutely not what we found in doing any of the analysis for her. My lab helped her with some of that. I agree with Judith. That's not a threat.
Gail writes, can these harmful chemicals and well, can I just ask the question, then why did Connecticut ban them?
You know, again, my suspicion is what Judith said. Okay. It was an excuse by people who did water.
Gail writes, can these harmful chemicals and lead be removed with household or faucet filters?
Yes. You can remove PFAS chemicals with carbon filtration. You can you know, it's not cheap. You can put a carbon filter either on your whole home or just on your sink for your drinking water. If you do it just for your sink, it'll run you about $750, and then you have to make sure you change the carbon filter as directed. Lead, I'm kind of stumped. I should know this. I don't know if carbon filtration removes lead. I'm sure one of your listeners knows the proper answer on that.
James writes, as a chemist, may I point out that for a long time, these chemicals were undetectable in drinking water. It required some major development in analysis to determine them. Go science.
Thank you, chemist.
Yes. Zuli writes, they have found PFAS in Waynesboro, Massachusetts, public water as well. They shut down the pump, yet we only have one more source of water. What happens when the chemicals seep down to that source? We are waiting on the government to get back to us. Not sure how this is going to help us get clean water, find where the pollution is coming from, and get it cleaned up.
Well, under this new EPA rule, they have 3 years to monitor and 2 years after that to install equipment. It seems they're going to have to filter in that location. There's not really another way to address it.
Judith, I couldn't resist, and I asked my local expert, which is ChatGPT, whether carbon filtering does remove lead from drinking water. And to make a very, very long answer short, the answer is no.
All right.
Yeah. I didn't think so, but I should know the answer to that. You know, it's kind of sad with PFAS. We can point to granulated active carbon, reverse osmosis, or ion exchange. And, you know, lead is such a serious issue. And the Biden administration included $10 billion in the Infrastructure Act for local governments to remove lead pipes. Certainly a big issue in Troy. And I'm happy that Troy is finally has the resources to replace. The problem is they're called lead service lines. It's the larger pipes that run from the street to your home. Everyone, if you're in an old house, I would say before 1978, you should have your water tested for lead, which is easy to do. And what I appreciate what's happening in Troy is they've been slow getting there, but they're finally going to replace some or all of the lead service lines, and they're not using PVC plastic as the replacement because that's just a mistake. And I wish EPA would provide some guidance to local governments. When you're removing lead service lines, the replacement material should be stainless steel or copper, preferably recycled copper, and not PVC plastic, because vinyl chloride was declared class one carcinogen 50 years ago. So we don't want to go from lead problems to vinyl chloride problems with the lead service line replacements.
Let's see. We'll go to Linda, who asks a very simple question. Dental floss? Please elaborate.
Yeah, it makes it slippery.
Nonstick.
Nonstick. Goes between your teeth. Is that, I thought that was wax, though, but there's other stuff in there, I assume.
It's never just innocent wax.
Well, it's all request Friday here on the roundtable. Lisa says, would Judith have a moment to speak to the biochar plan proposed for the town of Moreau? Is there still a chance to stop that project?
Absolutely. Yeah, local citizens are organizing to block that plant. There's plenty of time to block it. Just look in local media and you'll find names of people and organizations who are engaged, which kind of brings me to this broader point on, I truly believe that EPA would have not issued these regulations this week if not for extensive work done in Hoosick Falls and other communities around the country. But, you know, this conversation this morning has been very nostalgic in me thinking about the Hoosick Falls battle, and it was a battle. It would not have changed if not for the role of local media, specifically the Albany Times-Union and Brendan Lyons reporting and Scott Waldman's reporting when he was at Politico and certainly WAMC. And I'm worried that with the decline of local news coverage, an issue like Hoosick Falls, if it popped today, it definitely would have gotten coverage, but nothing like we saw when this issue first came to light. So, you know, another reason to be supporting local journalism. And then the other point I quickly wanted to make related to Jim is there's no doubt in my mind that if Donald Trump is elected president of this country, one of the first things he will do is pull back. He will repeal this EPA regulation on PFAS chemicals.
And a number of others, including recent auto pollution ones and other ones. I mean, yes, absolutely.
Anything on climate change, because that's what he did the first time.
And he's already said it. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, he's got EPA in the crosshairs. He's going to repeal a bunch of Clean Air Act and Clean Drinking Water Act regulations, which has a direct impact on people's lives.
A few minutes before the bottom of the hour, I'd like to move on to another topic. Congressional negotiations over data privacy and children's online safety took a step forward this week as House and Senate leaders unveiled bipartisan proposals and started ramping up their consideration of the measures. This from the Washington Post. Most notably, Senator Maria Cantwell, a Democrat of Washington, and Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers, a Republican of Washington, struck a deal on a comprehensive privacy bill, and House lawmakers unveiled a companion to the Kids Online Safety Act, raising the prospects that both could still move this Congress. The House is scheduled to debate those and other tech measures at a hearing next week, and the Senate could soon follow suit. But just like in years past, the same pesky friction points that have bogged down talks for years may surface again. So Jim, let us go to you and talk about some of those friction points.
So let me start by saying I feel about privacy the way Judith feels about plastic. The amount of information about you that is gathered from your online presence and nowadays even your offline presence just tied to if I'm in the same room with someone with a cell phone who takes a picture of me, things like that. And that information has virtually no privacy protection. Now, what is good about the current conversation is a place where there seems to be more willingness to agree is children's privacy, because that is an area where there has been existing law and there have been a lot of cases. So they're trying to get away from this issue of, you know, what are your privacy rights as an adult and start with, let's see if we can get some regulation for children. So that's one friction. But the other one is several states have passed privacy laws that are actually stronger than the ones that are being proposed, and particularly California. And therefore, there are people who are arguing that the federal law, which would overrule the state law, would then be, worse in some places. Now, you know, this is one of the strange things that goes on in politics, because you have a group who are finally doing something right and another group who did it even better saying, I'm sorry, you're going to hurt us. So to hell with the rest of the country. We, you know, let's keep California's law. I would love to see California's law. Actually, I'd like to see something even stronger than California's law become the federal law. But at the very least, you know, moving this children's stuff forward, I think, is absolutely crucial. And, I'm tempted to talk on this as long as somebody else talks on plastic, but I won't. I'll simply say, just pay attention to the fact that so much is known about everybody through their media presence. And virtually none of that falls under any legal binding stuff outside of things that promote specific kinds of violence, specific kinds of child pornography, things like that. But by and large, the privacy rights are insanely bad and what you can tell about someone is just amazing. And I'll stop there.
Thank goodness we're finally seeing some activity in seeking this kind of regulation, this kind of legislation, I should say. I thought it was interesting that it's two Washington State women, you know, elected officials, the Senate Commerce Committee Chair Martha Cantwell and the House Energy and Commerce Chair Kathy McMorris Rodgers, both from the state of Washington. The Microsoft vice chairman called it a good deal, providing clarity by establishing a national, you know, standard. I hope that it is not preemptive of state regulation and it sets a floor rather than a ceiling. I think that's the way to go. But the other issue that's on the table is whether or not there should be a private right of action. Can people sue for damages? That isn't clear. That's a bone of contention. And I also thought it was strange that in the Senate bill, companies with under $40 million in revenues would be exempt. And then companies with over $250 million in revenues would have a greater standard. I don't care if you earn less than $40 million in revenue. I still don't want you to be, you know, invading my privacy. So I don't know that revenue standards are the best way to go. I defer to experts who know more about that, how hard it is to implement and to abide by these regulations. But hopefully the federal federal legislation will be a floor, not a ceiling. And hopefully we can get through this right of action question. My big takeaway is even if we have a deal, is Trump going to step in and ruin it? I think we have to ask that question right now.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our panel. We'll wrap up the program for this Friday morning. And still time for you to get your letters in. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org.
Because I'm only human after all. I'm only human after all. And put your blame on me. Don't put your blame on me. Some people got the real problems. Some people like.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, listening to the music of Joanne Shaw Taylor playing the Mahewi on Friday, April 19th. That's next Friday at 8 p.m. And you can find out more information by going to mahewi.org. Mahewi.org. You can also see our playlist on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. Also, last call for letters, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. We have been talking about privacy and action that is being taken in the House and Senate. Jim, was there more you wanted to add on?
Yeah, I would add, you know, there's a couple of interesting things here that probably are worth mentioning. One is before when it was mentioned who were the two people pushing this, the two women from Washington, it's worth noting that one is a Democrat and one is a Republican and that this really is starting to build bipartisan support, which is good. The other thing I find interesting on this has been the response of big tech. If you look at, depending which list you look at, somewhere between 4 and 6 of the top 10 biggest companies in the U.S. or more than 20 of the top 50 biggest companies in the U.S. are companies that really live off of a lot of this data stuff. So you would expect them to be actually the biggest opponents of this. But strangely, and particularly in this child protection area, they are on board with there being some kind of regulation for the simple reason that right now, if, you know, I'm TikTok and I have 50 different states with 50 different regulations, that's really hard. If I'm, you know, Facebook and I'm taking information from all over the world and, you know, it's bad enough that I have to have warnings on stuff in Europe that are different than the warnings I have to have on stuff in the U.S., but if it starts becoming state by state. So big tech has mostly been willing to consider privacy legislation. However, they've been very, not unanimous on their response to adult privacy, consumer privacy protection, et cetera, et cetera. But children's privacy is an area that that's pretty easy for them to agree on. There can be a national standard on, you know, exactly how you check to see how somebody is actually a child, which is another whole technical issue. But by and large, you know, I can only see good coming out of this. I will say that some of those smaller, smaller companies, $40 million and such, a lot of those are considered small companies, but a lot of those are also the data brokers who make their money by servicing these large companies, and giving them a break seems to me to be something that I'm not crazy about. But like Judith, I don't want to see any exceptions to privacy laws.
All right. Let us talk now about the elephant in the room. NPR in turmoil after it is accused of liberal bias. This is an article in today's New York Times. For all of you who have sent us copies of this article over the past several days, all 480 of you, thank you very much. We have read it. It is, you know, at some point when you put something out on Substack and you think, okay, when does this become the right time to talk about it? And I think when it becomes a front page story in the New York Times may be the time that you want to address it. For those of you who may not be aware, NPR is facing both internal tumult and a fusillade of attacks by prominent conservatives this week after a senior editor publicly claimed the broadcaster had allowed liberal bias to affect its coverage, risking its trust with audiences. I just want to quickly comment, and I will say some of this is going to be very hard for me not to be snarky. However, when the first line is NPR is facing internal tumult, having worked here for 30 years as part of NPR, they have always been an internal tumult. I don't remember a time when NPR hasn't been in an internal tumult. However, it doesn't change the issue at hand.
Well, I also can't remember a time when public broadcasting and NPR weren't under attack by
under siege.
In fact, I brought my little friend with me today. I know it's radio, so you can't see it, but I have a little Big Bird.
That's right.
Which was one of the the first time I ever gave a reasonably big contribution to WAMC soon after I moved was because during one of the fundraisers around one of the election campaigns.
Mitt Romney saying we should get rid of
Big Bird. Mitt Romney saying we should get rid of PBS and Big Bird. And so this was one of the promotions. So I have my little Big Bird who has stayed on my...
So Yuri Berliner, a senior business editor who has worked at NPR for 25 years, wrote in an essay published Tuesday by The Free Press, a popular Substack publication, that, quote, people at every level of NPR have comfortably coalesced around the progressive worldview. Mr. Berliner, a Peabody Award-winning journalist, castigated NPR for what he said was a litany of journalistic missteps around coverage of several major news events, including the origins of COVID-19 and the war in Gaza. He also said the internal culture at NPR had placed race and identity as paramount in nearly every aspect of the workplace. Mr. Berliner's essay has ignited a firestorm of criticism of NPR on social media, especially among conservatives who have long accused the network of political bias in its reporting. Former President Donald Trump took to a social media platform Truth Social to argue that NPR's government funding should be rescinded, an argument he has made in the past, and many other Republican leaders have made that
point as well.
That's right. NPR has forcefully pushed back on Mr. Berliner's accusations and the criticism. We're proud to stand behind the exceptional work that our desks and shows do to cover a wide range of challenging stories. Edith Chapin is the organization's editor-in-chief and said in an email to staff on Tuesday, "We believe that inclusion among our staff, with our sourcing, and in our overall coverage is critical to telling the nuanced stories of this country and our world." Some other NPR journalists also criticized the essay publicly, including Eric Deggans, its TV critic, who faulted Mr. Berliner for not giving NPR an opportunity to comment on the piece. he must be a really popular guy in the office.
I
these
bet
days.
He's having fun at work now.
In an interview Thursday, Mr. Berliner expressed no regrets after publishing the essay, saying he loved NPR and hoped to make it better by airing criticisms that have gone unheeded by leaders for years. He called NPR a national trust that people rely on for fair reporting and superb storytelling. I decided to go out and publish it in hopes that something would change and that we get a broader conversation going about how the news is covered. He said he had not been disciplined by managers, though he said he had received a note from a supervisor reminding him that NPR requires employees to clear speaking appearances and media requests with standards and media relations. He said he didn't run his remarks to the New York Times by network spokespeople, so take that. When the hosts of NPR's biggest shows, including Morning Edition and All Things Considered, convened on Wednesday afternoon for a long-scheduled meet-and-greet with the network's new chief executive, conversations soon turned to the essay, according to two people with knowledge of the meeting. During the lunch, Ms. Chapin told the host that she didn't want Mr. Berliner to become a martyr. Mr. Berliner's essay also sent critical Slack messages whizzing through some of the same employee affinity groups focused on racial and sexual identity that he cited in his essay. In one group, several staff members disputed Mr. Berliner's points about a lack of ideological diversity and said efforts to recruit more people of color would make NPR's journalism better. Oy.
I like the numbers. I think anyone who's interested in this story should read Yuri Berliner's actual piece because he did try to raise these issues internally with management, and there's been a big change in the listenership, and maybe this is just a result of the polarization in our country. But in 2011, 26% of listeners of NPR identified as conservative. That's down to 11%. And in 2011, 37% of listeners thought they were liberal. Now it's 67%. But also importantly, the focus on racial equity and a racial lens hasn't really increased that much, the Black and Hispanic listenership. So I hear what he's saying, and I question whether or not you can actually remain neutral in a time where fascism is a risk to the country. So that's kind of where I come out. Would it have made sense for NPR back in Germany during the rise of Hitler to remain neutral? That's my question.
Judith.
And there's a big difference between NPR programming and NPR news reporting. Please do not go after, wait, don't tell me, anyone. But in terms of the news, I deal with national reporters all the time. I deal with AP, I deal with The Times, I deal with The Post, I deal with NPR. Just from my experience, NPR reporters are objective. They are not one-sided. They really strive to, dig out the facts. And I think the guy who works at NPR should actually talk to people like me who are sources for stories. And, do we feel like NPR is unfair in its reporting? No. I think NPR reporters, news reporters, are actually more rigorous than some other outlets. So I kind of, on one hand, I challenge the premise of lack of objectivity. And then on the other hand, I'm completely bored by his memo, and I hope it doesn't cause just major upheaval. Some introspection is always good, and increasing diverse voices are always good, but he seems to have painted with a pretty broad brush here.
So,
go ahead, Jim.
I was just going to throw in quickly that I did read the essay, and the three examples he used, which, by the way, are not what people are saying were all the examples he used, are things which still remain controversial, which I certainly have heard reporting on NPR. He claims NPR buried stories about whether COVID started in a lab or COVID started in, from the wild, saying, scientists are split on this and we should have been covering it more. Well, again, I've read that science. Right now, the overwhelming belief is not that it was a lab spread, although, again, it's not 100% clear, but how long is that going to be a story? For 2 years, 5 years, 50 years? Same thing with, you know, they keep claiming he says the coverage on Gaza was done. Gaza's not even, the word Gaza doesn't even appear in his editorial, so that must be from something he said somewhere else. And then he uses the example of Hunter Biden's laptop. Again, something that many news sources felt was a non-story until it had gotten validated, at which point it was reported on. So by and large, I just found, you know, if I had just seen that essay and didn't know it was written by someone claiming to be a liberal from NPR, I would have assumed it was the same essay I've seen 100 times from conservative critics.
Yeah, and I do think it is, and I'm not downplaying it, but the NPR is, and I think it even says this in the Times article, is no stranger to internal division. There's been a lot of internal fights, and so this is, you know, when it spills out into a public forum, then obviously a lot of people are going to pick it up and run with the ball. We're out of time. My thanks to everybody for being here. I appreciate you all, and I hope you have a beautiful weekend.
Thanks,
Joe. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.